I start to feel anxious. I'm getting followed by a guy. Like, my mind is panicking. I actually can't concentrate on driving because I know this person is just trying to follow us.
Strictly Finalists, written a book, a West End.
An internet sensation.
Joe Sugg.
You started at 19, 20 years old. By 22, you had about 6 million subscribers.
Yeah.
That's fucking nuts.
It was so uncertain about where that was going to go. The rise, but also the fall, can happen so quick. That imposter syndrome that I already had got amplified. Anxiety, self-doubt, the whole thing just didn't feel real.
Diane, you met her on Strictly.
First real proper girlfriend, yeah. The further you go in that competition, the higher the pressure is and the stress gets. We saw the best and the worst of each other. I always thought it would be a very private thing. It's actually ended up being the complete opposite.
Hand on heart, do you think if you'd never started YouTube, you'd be happier overall?
Good question.
So without further ado, I'm Stephen Bartlett, and this is The Diary of a CEO. I hope nobody's listening, but if you are, then please keep this to yourself. Joe.
Hello.
Tell me, what are the most important things that I need to know about you from your early years in order to understand you? In order to understand the man that you are today.
The man I'm today. I was quite a loud child. I was a loud, annoying child growing up. When we look back through like family videos, it's quite embarrassing to watch, particularly me, because I was the sort of boy that would be like, "Mummy, watch this, like repeating myself over and over again, and we're watching it back like, "Oh, shut up, like you were an annoying child." But then at some point I flipped, and I don't know when that was, but at some point I flipped and became a very sort of timid, quite a shy child. Always very creative, even from an early age. I was a good drawer. I used to illustrate and draw a lot of pictures at school, which definitely came from, passed down from my parents, mum and dad, both very creative in their own sense. I went to a very, very small primary school in rural Wiltshire. I think there's 52 pupils in our whole school. Going from there to secondary school was a big change for me, because that was going from 52 pupils in the whole school to over 1,000. So that was a big, which probably could have a reason why I went from being sort of quite a loud, annoying child to being a lot more sort of, oh, I'm at my depth here. I'm now a small fish in a big pond.
You were, I read in the book, in chapter one of Grow, that you were quite self-deprecating at that point.
In secondary school, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Primary school, I feel like primary school, I was a lot more confident. Everyone knew everyone very well, and I just felt like a lot more popular then. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, moving to secondary school, it was much more like, yeah, like I said, it was a very different place. And that's when I first sort of encountered teasing and bullying and stuff. And I wasn't necessarily like bullied, but it was more like if there was ever like teasing going on or things that they were trying to sort of dig, I very quickly sort of realized if I'm already sort of poking fun at myself, they will get bored of trying to poke fun at me. So there's less chance of that happening.
At that age in secondary school, would you consider yourself to be a confident child?
No. Do you know what? Silently confident. Like in my head, I've always been the sort of person where I know what I'm capable of. And like, I know that I think, you know, I know that I can do certain things to a good standard, and I know that I can be a good student and all this kind of stuff. But on the outside, not as confident at all. So like with work and stuff, I was very confident. I was confident that I'd be able to get the grades and do well in school and things like that. But it's more the sort of social side of it. I found that a lot more difficult.
Well, if I'd asked you at that age what you wanted to be when you grew up, what would you tell me? Say like 16-ish.
16, I wanted to work in media, but I wanted to be go more down the route of animation. My goal as a kid, first of all, it was an archaeologist.
Of course, yeah.
I wanted to be Indiana Jones. And then secondary school, I wanted to work for Aardman. I wanted to be an animator, like model builder, or just, I think I've got a lot of patience. And if you know what animation's like, or how long it took to make Chicken Run or Wallace and Gromit, you know, those films take a long time to make. So I wanted to, yeah, I felt like I'd be good to do that. I wanted to work for Aardman.
Your grades at A-level were really good.
Yeah.
Which was surprising, because then, you know, most people with those kind of grades that get A's and stuff would then go off to university.
Yeah.
You chose not to.
No, yeah. So we did work experience. I don't know if you did the same. Like when you turn 16, yeah. You have to
get went to a dentist.
Did you?
Yeah, I fell asleep every day, so.
I decided to go roof thatching with my uncle. So my uncle is a roof thatcher, which is a very old traditional craft that they don't really teach anymore. It's very like kind of, there's no classes you can go and take and you can't study for it. You've got to actually go on the job and work on the job, and you learn that when the master thatcher thinks you're ready, you then go from being an apprentice to a master thatcher. And I remember my school advised that I didn't do it, but I went and did it anyway. Shouldn't have done, sorry. So I went and did that, and then I absolutely loved it. I was outside. I think what it was is I was outside. It was tough. I was lifting a lot of straw and moving things and sweeping up, but I absolutely loved it. There's something about like when we finished a roof, we'd look at what we've done, and it's just that feeling. I wanted to bottle that up and be like, that's what I want for the rest of my life. So I decided that I wanted to be a roof thatcher for the rest of my life. I'm the sort of I'm very bad at making my mind up on things as well. There's a lot going on. I'm very bad at making my mind up on stuff. So I was like, what if it doesn't work out later on down the line? I need to have A levels. So if this doesn't go to plan, or, you know, after a while I don't like it, I can at least then try out university and go back to trying to work for something in the media or Aardman or something. So, but I didn't. I always like the idea of having safety nets underneath me. So if something doesn't go to plan, it's all right. You've always got that safety net of, and that's kind of like in a way what roof thatching became, because I started doing YouTube as a hobby off the back of the thatching. I did it in my spare time, and that started to take off and become a full-time career. But then I was in a way safe going into that, because I was like, if it all doesn't pan out, because this is going back to when YouTube wasn't really a career as well. So it was so uncertain about where that was going to go. But I always felt very like secure in the fact that I knew that if it didn't pan out, I'll try it for a year. If it doesn't work, I can go back to a job that I genuinely really, really love. So yeah.
The two ideas that almost in sort of collision there was this idea that you are very self-confident in your abilities and that you've always needed a plan B.
Yeah.
I was trying to make them make sense as two kind of separate ideas, because one of them sounded a bit like self-doubt. This idea that sometimes there's a struggle to make a definitive decision and that there's a need for a plan B. Are you someone that has self-doubt at the same time? Because I think it's possible to understand your talents but also have doubt in the future and how things will pan out.
Yeah, I'm the sort of person where I think of the best case scenario. So like I have those... I've got a very vivid imagination. So with everything that I go into, I always think of the best possible outcome, which then gives me that sort of self-confidence. But then I also have Mr. Self-Doubt on the other side, who finds the worst case scenario. And then they have a battle in my head of how I should think. And I think that's where the indecision comes from with a lot of stuff. I live with it. I'm glad I've kind of got it, because without I wouldn't want to always have the self-doubt there, and I also wouldn't ever always want to have the self-confidence there, because I think that would make me a completely different person, maybe a person that I don't like either. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I have both.
That's the thing with the self-doubt. If it's just a little bit too high, and I learned this actually from a guest on this podcast called Nir Eyal. He wrote a book on why we get distracted and ultimately like why we procrastinate on things. And he says procrastination is the result of us trying to avoid a task or thing that we have psychological discomfort associated with.
Yeah.
So when you're like, you know, you've got the essay to do, you'll end up doing the washing up because mm-hmm. that's a task you're competent in. And whereas with the essay, you know, there's loads of research to do. You're not necessarily, you don't feel comfortable starting yet. Yep. There's something missing. So there's mental psychological discomfort. So you just go do the dishes.
Yep.
And I think self-doubt is one of the things that leads us to have that psychological discomfort where we just kind of delay it and wait for that perfect time or
yep.
go do the dishes.
I have that all the time. And it's, I always say it's because I'm creative. It's because I'm creative. It's like I get scared. I don't know if scared's the right word, but I put it off. Like if I know I've got something I want to do that is creative and requires a lot of sort of sitting around thinking beforehand and then putting pen to paper or anything that's going to involve the creative process, I delay it. And I think it's a thing of like, what if I start doing it and instantly I don't like it? And I'm like, this is not how I imagined. Because you sort of, in your mind, you have this version of it's all going to come flowing out of the pen, or you're going to start filming something and it's all going to go perfect plan. And it doesn't. And it very, very often does it all just completely flow. And I think that kind of puts a block in. I'm always like, if I'm going to do it, I need to make sure everything's prepared beforehand.
That is very interesting. A lot of the time as well, we say to ourselves that the reason I'm not starting it or the reason I have that procrastination is because I'm a perfectionist. Everyone loves that because it's a nice way of framing yourself as having really, really, really high standards and being, honestly, it's kind of like saying the reason I've not started it yet or the reason I struggle is because I'm amazing.
Yeah.
It's almost like saying that when really a lot of the time it's probably self-doubt and that psychological discomfort associated with you don't feel fully competent or like you could fully nail it and you're trying to avoid the mess, which we all encounter as we do anything.
Yeah, I think it's like, it's kind of like that. I think it's from that part of my brain that's like seeing the best possible outcome. So like, let's say for example, I'm doing a painting. In my head, I'll have that thing of like almost going ahead because of my imagination, I see it finished and I'm like, it's gonna be amazing. It's gonna, you know, I'm gonna post it online and people are gonna love it and things like that. But then I start and it doesn't quite go. I'm like, oh, actually this is, in my mind, I've gone through this process of like, doing it over and over again and getting it to how I want it to go, and then I start doing it, it's not going how I imagined it, and that sort of scares me a bit, and that's why I think I put things off more from that kind of side.
Unfinished paintings?
Yeah, a lot of them. Too many of them.
what have you learned about, is there anything that you've learned or anything that's helped you get past that initial hesitancy of procrastination? Or because you know reading through your story and even speaking to you today, even before we started recording, I was like, God, this guy's got so many ideas.
I was going to say, that is something that I've struggled with, especially nowadays where like going into things like business, like starting businesses and stuff, I feel like from what I've seen, very rarely do you see people that are doing so many different things. And it is that thing of like, I'm a plate spinner. Like I love spinning plates of different things and trying to keep up with these spinning plates. And I take time to sort of sit back and look at these things and think, when are you going to sit on one thing and actually just do that thing and devote your, because you see like, you look throughout history of like artists and people who have devoted their whole life to sculpting. Do you know what I mean? And I sort of tell myself, I'm not going to achieve anything sort of near that if I don't dedicate my whole life to one thing. But for me, I just find it so difficult because I'm like, I've got a limited time and I want to dip my toe into everything. And it's weird because I feel like I use this analogy, and I don't know if it's a great analogy or not, but with the YouTube sort of career that I've had over the last 10 years, that is something that I did sort of double down on and really focus all my energy on at one point. But then it became a point of branching it out and doing different things, just as a form of like stability as well, because we didn't know, back in those days, we didn't know how long it's gonna last for. So we did sort of branch out into different things. And I think I just got a bit carried away with the branching out, and just, I was like, there's so many things to sort of see and try out and do. I see like that YouTube thing of like catching going out to sea and catching a wave, and caught that wave in. And it was incredible. It was a record breaking wave. It was a major wave kind of thing. And you know, and now I feel like I'm back out on my board again and I'm paddling around. I've caught a few little waves, but they've not been like another, you know, ripper of a wave like the YouTube one was yet. But I'm sort of like, I know that there's more big waves out there, but it's just kind of like knowing which way you start paddling, you know, like how surfers sort of start to paddle out trying to catch them, and you watch them, they sort of get it and then doesn't go. And it's like, I feel like at the moment I'm sort of paddling out and sort of waiting for that sort of next big wave, in a sense.
Why do you need a next big wave?
Good point. I should just stay on the beach. I think that's actually what my therapist, I have a therapist I speak to, and I use that analogy with her, and she said the exact same thing. Why do you need to catch the next big wave? Why not stay on the beach? You don't need to go out and constantly catch big waves.
I was thinking this because you said earlier, I mean, the question I was going to ask before you talked about the wave analogy was kind of similar, which is, if you're happy spinning multiple plates and trying lots of things and sculpting for the joy of sculpting, it seems like, and this is, I'm guilty of this in the biggest way, it seems like there's this other narrative which is saying, no, forget what you love doing, focus, because success is the most important thing.
Yeah.
And when I say success, I mean like accomplishment.
Yeah.
Because real success probably is actually being happy.
Yeah.
And you're happy, like, but it's almost like we deny ourselves of happiness because there's not a gold medal there, or there's not a gazillion followers there.
Yeah.
But you're enjoying sculpting.
Yeah.
For the sake of sculpting.
It's like a punishment of yourself. Like, I feel like it's kind of like a form of like, Joe, you know, you love doing this and this makes you genuinely happy, so why don't you just do it? Do you know what I mean? And if you love it that much and you stick at it and do it, then good things may come from it, but it's not going to happen straight away. And it's like, it's almost like I get into a thing of like, I like to sort of, the things that I know I love doing, I put aside and I focus on the things that that maybe I don't love as much or not as passionate about as much. But I'll sort of almost put that before the little things that make me really happy. It's bizarre. Wow. I have no idea. I've tried to like think about it a lot, and it's weird that it comes from, I don't know where it comes from.
Because, but are you saying because those things you could be, although you might not love them as much, you might be able to be successful in the eyes of the world in them? Or
I think it's because I've got that thing in me that's looking for instant success and stuff, which is weird. And maybe that's because of, like, before on YouTube and stuff, there was a time where, you know, we were, I say we, like, might speak for myself, but like me and a lot of the people around at similar time that on that sort of wave that we were on, we all, everything we sort of would go into almost became an instant success in a way. It was like,
gold, yeah.
I think it's because we, like, back then, I felt like it was so much bigger. Anything you sort of went into, you know, it did end up sort of getting attention and doing really well and things, whereas now, maybe not so much. And I think that's kind of crazy.
We signed some YouTubers back in those days, so. Maybe not, because you were very, very early, but in 2013-14 we signed a bunch of YouTubers, and still to this day none of them were as near the size of you and that sort of British cohort of like YouTube megastars. But still to this day, and they must have been 18, 19, 20 years old, I still think it ruined their lives.
Yeah.
Because I watched an 18-year-old, 19-year-old kid who had started a YouTube channel, got to 200,000, 300,000 subscribers when there was no video. That was the only shop in town for video.
Yeah,
this
was
before Facebook video and Instagram and Snap and all, and Twitter video.
Yep.
So that was where, as brands, we were just pumping all the money into these YouTubers.
Yep.
I watched those kids turn down 15 grand to show up to a fucking movie premiere.
Yeah.
Or to just show face. When that wave comes into shore and hits the beach and it's over.
Yeah.
Those kids are in a psychological trap almost with their own personal expectations of the world. And I really worry about that, because success can be a curse because of the way it messes with our own personal expectations of ourselves and of the world.
Yep.
And in some respects, that sounds like what you're saying. Your expectations back then, everything you guys touched did turn to gold.
Mm. Yeah.
Now you're saying it's a little bit more difficult.
Yeah. Bronze.
Does any of that resonate with you?
Oh, 100%. Yeah, I think that's a big part of why myself and Casper, who's also a YouTuber, we started a management company, because in the future there's going to be kids. I mean, we've already seen it then, like young kids that were shooting to fame overnight. But even I think nowadays with other social medias, it happens even quicker. Like the rise, but also the fall can happen so quick. And I was like, for me and Casper, we were like, we want to make a management company. A big role of what we have in that is being, in a way, kind of like mentors when needed to for any questions they have or anything that any concerns they have about that kind of thing. We can sort of give it's, I kind of use it as like a, I guess like the, you know, like the Hunger Games, that guy who's like sat on the train, he sort of takes her through it and be like, look, this is going to happen. I guess like a mentor. A very different version of, yeah, like, yeah, kind of like mentor, yeah, kind of role.
Yeah.
And that for me is like one of the, like the best things that I do at the moment is having that sort of one-on-one with our own clients, and sort of if they've got any sort of issues, being able to actually offer advice and see it make a change.
I'm Joe at 19.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're Joe at 30.
Right.
What do you say to me? I'm about to, but as you were, I'm thinking about uploading that first video. And
yeah.
What advice would you give me?
I would say, if you want it to get to that level, you can do it. If you put in the sort of the consistency and you're making stuff that is going to get seen and stuff, but just be prepared for there's other sides of it that aren't all bells and whistles and that kind of thing. There's going to be obstacles. There's going to be things that you're going to need advice on, and we're going to be here to help and hold your hand through that if you need it.
What are the things that are wrong?
Press, negative press, you know, haters. You're going to get trolls. That's the bigger audience size, the more issues it brings in terms of the more eyes that are on you, the more people that will watch your stuff that might not like what you do, and then they've got a thing out against you, and there's a lot.
What's the mental cost?
I would say that if you're me, it's still worth it. It's still, don't ever regret doing it. It's still worth it. Like you, there of course there's negatives, but the positives that you've gained out of it, or you will gain out of it, in everything outweighs a negative. And don't get bogged down by the negatives, because there's more there's going to be more positives than negatives. The negatives don't matter as much as you think they're going to matter at the time. At the time when you experience these negatives and these things that, you know, don't go your way, or that's going to happen, but don't dwell on it, don't let it consume you, because there's positives beyond that, and you'll look back and you won't regret it.
What is the worst thing that's going to happen to me?
The worst thing that's going to happen to you
over the next 10 years. So I'm 19 years old. You know how it all plays out.
Yeah. Overthinking. Overthinking and worrying about what other people, how they perceive you.
What cost is that going to have?
A few sleepless nights. A lot of anxiety, self-doubt.
I'm guessing at 19 years old, Joe didn't know what anxiety was.
No.
What is it?
It's a feeling of claustrophobia, feeling a bit trapped.
Do you remember days through that period? I mean, you talked a little bit in the book about, I think, 2015 or so. Couple of years in. I mean, so you said earlier you started at 19, 20 years old. By 22, am I correct to say that you had about 6 million subscribers?
Possibly, yeah.
That's fucking nuts.
It happened really quick. I was very fortunate that my sister Zoe sort of, and Alfie actually, her partner, they really encouraged me to do it. Before YouTube, we used to buy blank cassette tapes and make our own radio shows, or but podcasts back in the day, like as like kids, we were always taking our parents' camcorder and recording shows. And Zoe was very much like the leader in that. She was very much sort of the director, let's say. And I was always the sort of, I just did what she told me to. Like I was the little brother that would just go along with it and that kind of thing. And so when YouTube came around, she started to get a bit of success from it. And she was like, you should give this a go, because it's the kind of stuff that we were doing as kids or have done. We're kind of like, it's not that far off from what we used to do, but you know, there's an audience that can watch you from around the world, so I gave it a go, and I think back then the success of like some of the stuff we filmed back then it'd be like a drop in the ocean now in terms of like how big social media's got and YouTube and stuff. Our stuff wouldn't be watched nowadays. It was like we were very much kind of hit it at the right time, so I started and it just sort of snowballed, and it snowballed really quickly. I remember there was a time where I was still thatching on a roof 5 days of the week. And then had an email come through asking if I'd go to fly out to Los Angeles to interview Simon Cowell. And yeah, I flew out there, and it was all first time ever experiencing a business class flight. I still had like straw in my shoes from like being on the roof and like hadn't showered, like kind of like just grotty Thatcher, getting on this plane, like a chauffeur driven car pulled up to a house and took me off to the Heathrow airport. And I went through the, there's like a little secret bit where they put these barriers down. You have your own like private security kind of thing, and you go through, and I was like, it just blew my mind. And I hadn't even got to Los Angeles yet. First time ever flying on my own, like solo. And that whole experience was just like, the whole thing just didn't feel real. Just did not feel real. It just felt like I was sort of like living like a double life in a way of like, like yesterday I was on a roof thatching, and now I'm sat in Simon Cowell's fancy house sort of talking to him about Skype.
Those experiences, especially when they're really quick, and they go from 0 to 100. People, when I sit here with them, often talk to me about imposter syndrome.
Yeah.
Because, you, as you said, you're kind of living a double life. You're like, what the fuck am I doing? Yeah. I've got a straw on my shoe and Simon Cowell. And
definitely, yeah. Imposter syndrome, there's definitely a lot of that going on.
And that must result in overthinking and doubt and all those things we talked about.
And that's another thing, actually, that I would say to younger Joe is that you're going to get this thing called imposter syndrome. You'll learn about it later, but yeah, it'll be there. And I've had that even now to this day. Like even now with this podcast, like I've listened to this podcast all the time, and even on the way here, I was a bit nervous because I was like, you get like these, you know, these incredible CEOs on, and these people that are so good at talking, and I struggle to get a sentence together most of the time, and I'm like, I feel like there's people on there that have done such amazing things, and I'm like, for me, it still gives me that little bit of imposter syndrome of like, there should be other people, there's a lot more people that should be sat in this chair rather than me.
What's the risk of that? Because you know, I imagine a lot of people, for me the risk is you end up like avoiding like opportunities in life and stuff, because I'm sure there must have been people that we've asked to come on this podcast before that through imposter syndrome said no. Like they, because we do get a lot of people come here and they'll say a similar thing. We've had, I mean, I can think of a few people who literally came here and was like, I don't know why you've asked me to be here. Ooh. And that must impact performance. It must make the whole thing unpleasant. I mean, at least the lead up anyway.
Yeah.
Until I'm such a, you know.
It does, yeah. I think like a good example for me is doing Strictly, or even actually probably even more so is Waitress in the West End. So yeah. I did a stint on the West End in Waitress, and this was coming off the back of doing Strictly, so my confidence actually, it completely changed me in a sense that it gave me such a big boost of confidence, which I hadn't had for a long time. And so riding on that confidence, I agreed to do a audition for Ogie in Waitress in the West End. And I remember I kept asking sort of my team, being like, have they asked me because of like Strictly, or you know, will they be honest, and like if I'm not good enough, will they just tell? I don't want them to sort of put me in it if I'm actually not good, because I'm not to standard that they'd take someone on, do you know what I mean, if it's not me. And they were sort of like, I think you're, you know, just go along, you'll do this kind of stuff. And I remember even after doing the audition and they said they really loved it and things like that, I was still like, but did you though? What, like, are you sure? And especially like the backlash that I kind of got from that was quite like, I mean, it's nothing that sort of worried me too much, but there was a lot of like people that was messaging me being like, you don't deserve this. There's people that have trained their entire lives in musical theater and they won't ever get that opportunity because people like you coming in taking those roles. And so I started to have like a massive, and that kind of like that imposter syndrome that I already had got amplified, and I was like, maybe I shouldn't do it. And just sort of, but then I wonder if there's been any times where people have then turned around and said, actually, do you know what, I don't want this because of what people on social media have said, do you know what I mean, or given their opinion on. So that was a real sort of, that was a definitely a moment that stands out to me of being like, I probably shouldn't be here doing this.
In your journey with social media and YouTube, was there a moment where you go, that was where I really started to see the symptoms of getting burnt out by doing this? Was there a year or a time where you just thought, fuck, I don't want to open my emails, I don't want to upload?
Yeah, it was I think around 2016-17, I think it might be. I remember it clearly because it was just a time where there was just a lot going on. I think YouTube was like massive. We were, you know, I had three YouTube channels that I was trying to all keep up at the same time. And this was actually before I had any, I was doing it all solo as well. So I'd think of the ideas, I'd shoot them all, edit them, obviously distribute it, I guess kind of in a way market it by promoting it and putting it out there and trying to get people to watch my stuff. But I also had a book coming out, which I was working on. We'd also, me and Casper did a feature with BBC Studios, like a sort of straight to DVD kind of like film of us sort of traveling around in a camper van. So there's a lot of things going on and obviously lots of other different things in the background. And it got to a point where I was like, my life as a roof thatcher before all this was, there was no feeling like this, how I'm feeling now. It was just, I had such a solid structure, like up at this time, go to work until this time, go back, unload the straw, load up the van again, go and see my nan, give her the paper, go home, go to the gym, and then that was it.
Was that happy your life?
There's been a lot of times throughout my life where I've looked back and thought, that was like, I think it's because that's that structure, it does make you feel like it's, I was living a more, yeah, yeah.
Hand on heart, do you think if you had never started YouTube, you'd be happier overall over the last 10 years? Hand on heart.
I think I'm more happy the route I've gone down as well. I think, because the thing is, I can never sort of, as much as, you know, I've had my struggles online and stuff, the online has also been such a big help for me, and especially like in terms of like YouTube and the way that I've worked with them and personally and like had support from them has been incredible. So I'm very fortunate as a creator on YouTube that YouTube has actually given me a lot of support, and I've had a good team around me that have given me the support. Mm-hmm. And the friendships and the family that I've had around me. Although I went through a time where I did struggle a lot, and I had that burnout and I had that sort of anxiety and worry and self-doubt and stuff, I've had a really good set of people around me that have helped me sort of get past that. Even with the roof thatching, you know, I look back on it now because I'm so far down a different path. But if I went back to thatching, I'm sure there were times where I'd be up on the roof when it's like sideways rain, wind, freezing cold, thinking like, what am I doing up here? Like, So I think it's all sort of comparative to where you are at certain points in your life.
Did your love for YouTube shift though? Because obviously you start posting less frequently on your main channel.
Yep.
To the point where, it's funny because as someone that's kind of observed the whole YouTube journey over the years, there seems to have been this point, which you've literally spoken about, where multiple YouTubers appear to have kind of vanished a little bit.
Yeah.
And then they end up posting a video saying, like almost giving their reason why, saying they're going to come back. Post another one a year later saying they're going to come back and they never come back. What is going on?
I can't speak for everyone, but for myself personally, I think it's partly because my audience have all grown up, or the audience that I had back then, they've all got older. They're all in their sort of, I presume a lot of the ones started watching me when they were 14, 15. They're all now in their 20s. They've got their own stuff going on. And the stuff that I knew how to make back then is not what they want to consume now as content. It's what I sort of gauge from it.
I have a guess as well, which is I think very much in line with what you're saying. I think that the algorithm might have changed a little bit.
Yeah.
And I think a few things happen when that happens. So I think as a creator, you get psychologically demotivated.
Yeah.
When you're doing the same work and you're getting a vote from your audience to say, which sounds like we don't like it.
Yeah.
Anymore.
Yeah.
And then it seemed like that happened all at the same time with that initial sort of YouTube cohort. Mm. And so a lot of them, because they saw declining numbers in whatever they were making, decided to try other formats and other things and go into other places. I remember back in the day, like YouTube seemed to be much shorter form videos.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And now you have a lot of long form stuff, a lot of 55 minute, hour, Joe yeah. Rogan, 3 hour videos on there.
Yes. There's always like rumors that go around being like, oh, this, you heard the latest, this is what now, yeah. you know, this is what the algorithm wants and stuff. And I agree with that to a degree, but I also think you've got the people that take it to the extreme sometimes and like, you know, the reason why I'm not doing this is because of this. And I never want to solely blame it. I think that's why I don't always blame it on an algorithm. This might go back to me being the sort of self-doubting kind of imposter syndrome type vibe again, of thinking like, it's not just because of this mechanical thing that goes on in the background. It's also because I need to switch things up and change my, you know, who I am online or what I'm doing online. I need to shift what I'm doing with the times, and I think that's harder than I thought when I was sort of like, I'm going to change my stuff now, and I think it's more difficult than I thought.
Was there a point where you saw numbers decline and you thought, where you start to think, wait a minute, this is not how it used to be?
Yeah.
When was that?
It was right before I said yes to doing Strictly. I thought, you know, it'll be fine. They'll get used to it and try with different content and things. And I started to post different stuff and it just wasn't performing as well as it used to. And I'd always kind of like prepared myself for it. Like my dad actually gave me a good piece of advice looking back on it, of being like, this, what you're doing now is great, but you know, in the future, it's only gonna get more and more people trying to do what you do. And there's gonna be people, there's always people out there that have new talents and stuff, and it's gonna change over time, and there's gonna be people that come into this that have got, you know, not saying that there's gonna be people that come into it that have got super talent and stuff that just completely dominate and things in it. So you unless you've really got something about you, you're gonna struggle to keep up because it's just gonna get bigger and bigger. And I kind of like, I look back now, I'm like, actually a lot of what he said makes sense. You know, there is, you know, it's that's the sort of way it's gone.
How do you define yourself now? Who are you now, like, as a, from a self-definition point? Not that that's something I like to do to myself, I don't like to self-define. But if someone asks you to write a bio, what do you say?
It's one of the hardest things for me to answer. It genuinely is. If I'm ever asked to sort of sum myself up what I do, I think it's like my Instagram bio is like, I am creative or something like that. Cause I find it so hard to sort of pigeonhole myself as this is what I do and this is what I am. So I'd say like, it's difficult. I just like to say like, I'm just a creative person.
I am so excited to announce our new sponsor for this podcast, and that is BlueJeans by Verizon. For any of you that aren't already familiar with BlueJeans, they are a video conferencing and collaboration tool who offer an immersive communication experience that drives pretty unparalleled employee and customer engagement experiences. Me and all of my teams across all of my portfolio companies switched over to BlueJeans a couple of months ago, and we have not looked back. The best thing for us has been the totally frictionless experience. No glitching, no sound issues, no delays, or any of those things that usually make virtual meetings really, really frustrating. We use BlueJeans anywhere, on any device, at any time, and it's perfect for my small businesses that just have 10 or 20 people to some of my bigger businesses that have hundreds of people. I'm a big fan, as you can probably tell, so I've been quite excited for some time to announce this partnership. And in the coming weeks, I'll explain the features and really why it's perfect for you if you haven't considered using or switching over to BlueJeans yet. But if you can't wait, head over to BlueJeans.com to learn more. Honestly, it's been one of the real sort of game changers in my business. You wrote a book, Grow, yes, about being outside and in nature. It seems like a fairly unobvious topic for someone like yourself to write about. So it was very compelling.
Mm.
Why did you decide to write about this, about the importance of going outside?
During the lockdown, we were all sort of looking for things to keep us busy, and I, like we've mentioned before, I love hobbies. I'm always looking for things to do. And I had like a balcony that ran off from my living area, and I got into gardening in that small little balcony of the things that I could do at the time and the things I had lying around. I got really into it, and I was like sort of like caring for a plant and just trying to make a plant grow, or putting time and effort into something else. and sort of not being in the sort of the whirlwind that's going on online on our phones and stuff at that time, disconnecting myself from that and sort of reconnecting myself with something as simple as nature made me feel so good. It took away all kind of like anxieties. I just felt very calm and very like, it took me back to my childhood in a sense of like how I grew up. I was very lucky to grow up in a little cottage type place. So getting all that thoughts, it's part memoir. Like I talk a lot about like growing up in the countryside and like, and sort of things actually living in London and all that kind of stuff, but also a part practical guide of hopefully giving some tips for other people in terms of like how they can find their own balance that suits them in terms of the real world and social media world.
It's quite a personal pivot, isn't it? Going from being a YouTuber who's uploading across 3 YouTube channels and is glued to a screen to standing here holding these pots.
Yeah, it is very different. I think, but that's kind of like how I've been. I like to separate out like those two things, and what I've realized is separating those two things out is really beneficial for me. But it's in no way sort of saying that social media is bad and this kind of thing, you shouldn't be on social media, because like it's a tool that we all use and we kind of like need to use, like in terms of like we've got a personal computer in our hands, it's kind of like an extension of our arm. We use it for so many things, so it's not saying like don't use your phone is evil. It's more kind of like finding a balance that's right for you that is going to help you feel better about yourself mentally.
On that point of thinking, mental health has become an increasing conversation over the last 10 years. Social media has kind of sat in the middle of that debate. Being someone that started a big social media business, I talk about this a lot. And obviously, you know, people, when we talk about social media and mental health, they'll say, well, you made all your money from it. So, and my rebuttal is always the same, which is, you know, if I've spent 10 years within it and I knew there was something wrong and I didn't tell you, yeah. That'd make me even more of an asshole, right? Yeah. Just because it had made me money. So, having been a, like very deep in social media over the last 10 years, I think we're probably more qualified than most to talk about the impacts it has on us, the mind, for better and for worse. When you were going through your hard times with social media, when you were having those real anxious moments where you've written a few things about how there was about a 2-year period with when you'd really got going, where you just had this overwhelming sensation that felt like it was impossible to escape. Were you telling anybody about it? Were you talking to people? Were you speaking to Zoe, your family, and saying, I'm getting anxiety right now?
Yeah, more so my sister, because my sister has suffered with it a lot throughout her career. So I was very lucky that I could speak to her about it, and obviously got a therapist as well that was recommended to me through my sister.
Do you remember that first time you spoke to her about it?
She was very good about it, to be fair, because she's been through a lot of that stuff. She sort of straight away made me feel better in knowing that, at least sort of acknowledging what it is and bringing some sort of understanding to it. But it definitely helped having someone so close to me like my sister being able to sort of help with that.
And you spoke to a therapist about this?
Yes.
Going to see a therapist has a lot of stigma surrounding it. So especially men are often very reluctant to do that, because I think especially once upon a time, going and seeing a therapist meant that I was crazy.
Oh yeah, yeah.
So your journey to actually getting into therapy, can you talk to me about that process and what pushed you ultimately to take that step?
Yeah, I think for me it was, I never saw it as a sort of, I don't know whether it's because of my sister, once again, like through everything sort of in a way sort of paving the way through that of like being like, she was seeing a therapist. So I already felt like, well, if my big sister can do it, then I can. Do you know what I mean? If she can do it, I could do it. So I was quite lucky in a sense that it was actually a very easy process for me.
What has therapy done for you practically? Is there anything you go, that's, it really helped me with that particular challenge that I had?
It's made me realize that I am I've got a thing about people pleasing. I'm a people pleaser. So I often feel like I can't be my unapologetic self in a situation without risking causing offense to someone. I'm like terrified of upsetting someone or saying the wrong thing. I'm learning through therapy that how to sort of manage that and to acknowledge it first and foremost, and then to sort of, and we're working on that at the moment, of trying to sort of work on like why I have this thing of being worried so much about what other people think about what I do.
It's a tough business to be in if you have that as a kind of predisposition. Has your therapist been able to offer you any advice about overthinking at all?
Yes. More so in like the sort of anxiety side of things. There was I think two or three points that she suggested, and it's like decatastrophizing the catastrophe, using time to separate. So like if I'm feeling anxious, I've got a sort of, the way you think about time helps. For example, I was at Chelsea Flower Show recently with my mum, and I was engaged in conversation with someone else, and but my mind was thinking like, there's so much going on around me, and I started to feel anxious, and I just needed to get out of there. And it started to make me feel sick that I was like, I couldn't leave. And I remember I had a glass of champagne in my hand, and I was like, I don't know what to do, because I was starting to think of all these different scenarios of being like, I can't just be sick here because I'm in like someone's garden. I can't just run away and leave mid-conversation because I'm so worried about going to them. Sorry, I can't listen to what you're saying right now because my mind is panicking. I need to go. I was so worried about how they would think of me. So it's like all that going on. But what I've learned is that if you take that and think this conversation is max going to last 5 minutes, that helps. And it's like, know that after those 5 minutes, you can walk over there and you can be on your own and you can do this kind of stuff, and it's going to help. So it's like kind of like if you're going into something that you think, oh, this is going to be a 5 hour thing or like a 2 hour exam, you break it down into like chunks. So it's like, I've got, okay, this 2 hour exam is 4 30-minute chunks. Mm. And that starts to make me feel less anxious about things. And then also sort of thinking ahead of that whole thing. So if you've got an exam, thinking, well, after this, I'm going to go and do this, this, and this, and this. And when you're thinking about things further in the future, it actually starts to make me feel more calm.
Diane, you met her on Strictly.
Yes.
Strictly gave you a lot, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. Yeah, yeah.
What was really interesting is that was your first girlfriend.
Yeah.
That's
first, yeah.
First real girlfriend.
First real proper girlfriend, yeah.
At what age?
27, 26?
Yeah.
God.
I wonder if, had you met her outside of Strictly, if you would be together.
Yeah.
Because it seems like you would have done a pretty good job of overthinking your way.
We have the same conversation. We're like, how lucky it was in a way that we were even partnered together. Because when you're partnered, if we weren't even partners on the show, we're on the same show, we still say we may not have got together. Because when you're actually with your partners, you don't see each other throughout the week. So we're like this, we sort of see it as like the stars sort of realigned there, but it wasn't, it was an odd sort of situation, I guess. It's not how I thought it would happen. I used to be quite like nervous about sort of getting a girlfriend publicly, because I would always think, because at the time I had this sort of large young female demographic that were really into sort of what I did and things like that. And I was kind of like, I've seen through like friends that have got girlfriends, you know, and when they introduce their girlfriends to their audience, it's a bit kind of like I always thought it would be a very private thing. And in my head, the whole time I was like, it'll be very private. And it's actually ended up being the complete opposite. It's like, you can now watch the moment we met, which is kind of unusual.
It seems, from just speaking to you today and getting to know you a bit, it does seem like that was the perfect way for you to get past, because you were forced together.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's, you know what I mean? In the context of the show, you were forced to spend time with each other. You weren't there to fall in love, but no. They put you together to do this very quite intimate thing, very deep journey over many, many months.
Yeah.
And it feels like, from just understanding you a little bit, that was probably the best way for you to get past a lot of that, sort of talking yourself out of it.
100%. And you know what? You see I feel like, in that environment anyway, especially for me, it's like I feel like we saw the best and the worst in each other over that sort of 16-week period. Mm. There have been times where we go into training and like things weren't going to plan, we thought we're going home, and we, you know, stress, the further you go in that competition, the higher the pressure is and the stress gets and things like that. So we saw the best and the worst of each other, within those 16 weeks. And I was, and afterwards I was kind of like, when we even sort of like had time to really kind of sort of address things like post, and be like, I actually kind of want to spend more time with you. Cause I felt like I kind of, I've seen the best and the worst, and I can, you know, I'm happy with that, and it, and it's vice versa. And so, so yeah, that's how it, you know, that's how it sort of happened.
So the show ends.
Yeah.
You get to the final, you do very well. And it's then you did the tour.
Yes.
Which everyone, a lot of people do, and they love that process as well. When did you decide that your dance partner was not just a dance partner and was a girlfriend?
It was before the tour.
Before the tour?
It was before the tour,
after Strictly, but before the tour.
Yeah, it was after the show finished. And like a few days after, we had time to sort of like, we obviously missed each other because we didn't see each other. So after we were like, sort of like, I do miss, like miss spending time with you and things like that. And so obviously we had a conversation, had a sort of decided and to see each other more often and things like that. And we actually then went away to a place in the New Forest.
Wait a minute, that was very quick. You had a conversation on WhatsApp or in person?
No, like in person.
Okay,
yeah,
so you met up a few times in person.
Yeah, yeah.
You didn't go straight to the forest.
And then we went to the New Forest, like a little trip.
Right.
And I remember we were getting like followed, because it's like there's a lot of like attention on us at the time, yeah. I think, and so yeah, we were getting followed by a guy. Like I'm very like sort of aware of like what's going on around me and stuff. I think it's just from the career that I've had over the last 10 years. I don't know, but I'm like, I was like, that guy is parked. I could see from my flat. I was like, that guy's parked there. He's a
paparazzi.
Yeah, and this is going to sound really like really wanky, but I was lent an Aston Martin that morning. So I went down and I was like, this is the best. I do things like this more often. I get lent cars like this. And I was like, and so I went down and parked it, and he must have seen me parked. So he knew what car to follow. And later on that day, I was driving along and I looked in the rearview mirror. I was like, I think we're being followed. And then and I recognized the license plate or something to do with the car. And it put me on so much edge. I was like driving along thinking like, I actually can't concentrate on driving because I know this person is just trying to follow us. So I sort of turned off from where I was trying to go to, because I don't want them to actually turn up to where we're going. So I was like trying to like
shake him off
a little bit. So I was like, right, Diane, you know how to work Bluetooth. He's like, yeah, put on the James Bond theme song. And we had that moment of just like trying to sort of avoid this guy who was following us, and we did manage to do it, obviously very safely.
Did the pictures come out in the paper?
No, nothing, luckily, because we were on the move. But yeah, I remember that very clearly, of that kind of like a moment of being like, this is not what I'm used to at all. Don't know if I like this, but then yeah, that's where we sort of. Yeah, that's where.
You're a couple of years into the relationship now.
Yeah.
You live together, right?
Yes.
Yeah. How's it going?
Yeah, it's going good. Yeah, going really well. It's really nice because we are both very, like, she's also one of the professional dancers. So she's still very much involved in the show. And when the show is not on, she's involved in the tours and things like that. So a lot of our time is separate. And we had 1 year, obviously 2019 was a year where we were like together, and but we had our own stuff that we're working on. It's a very busy year for me, and also a very busy year for her with like tours. And back then, even like, I think they do like cruise, like they did like cruise ships and stuff as well. So like loads of different tours and stuff. So we were away a lot of the time. But then when we come together, it's so nice because we've got so much to, they say like distance makes the heart grow fonder and all that kind of stuff. And I genuinely do believe in that, I think, especially in this sort of situation. Like, although we are away from each other a fair bit because of our work commitments and stuff, it works really, really well. And like when we are together, it's nice just to spend quality time together. But yeah, no, I'm absolutely loving it.
We have a closing tradition on this podcast where the previous guest asks a question for the next guest, not knowing who they're asking it for. Do you remember a moment where you realized that you loved your job? When was it and why? And was there a moment when you realized you hated your job? When was it and why?
Ooh, good question. The moment that I remember that I loved my job was, there's a lot of little moments that stick out, but I think this was going back to like the old YouTube gang. So like me, my sister, Alfie, Marcus, Butler, Jim, Tanya, a lot of that kind of the brick crew we were called back in the day. We got invited to Harry Potter World. And I'll admit I'm not the biggest Harry Potter fan, but just being around, like having like a day out with that group, that first sort of, because it's kind of like our first sort of big group out somewhere, and just being around these people, and we're all going through the same situation, which I really appreciate the fact that there's people within this group that I could chat to and speak to about what was going on. And it was such a new and exciting time, and we were all kind of on that journey up. And I just remember that memory's always stuck in my head. And there's a vlog. We all vlogged it. So it's like, it's actually been documented, so we can go back and watch it in the future and stuff. But that really sticks out.
So what about the second part of that question?
A moment where I hated my job.
Yeah.
I guess it was the time where I had that burnout feeling, and I had so much going on. I just thought, you know what? I actually don't really know if I want to do this anymore. And I remember telling my manager at the time, Alex, that I was like, I just don't know if I want to do this. There's too much going on. I actually can't really handle it. And I'm thinking about my old job and how much sort of simpler that was, and thinking like, it's like, but I had all these things going through my head of like that thing of like, don't be ungrateful, but also I am struggling with it. And I guess in that moment would feel like the time that I hated it, but it didn't last very long, because my manager at the time, Alex, she sent me a care package. She like went out and above and beyond and sent me this care package of like a book, and weirdly it was a Harry Potter book, which, as we know, not the biggest fan, but yeah, at the time it was exactly, like I said, it's exactly what I needed. But right before she saved the day, it was
tough.
Probably about that time, I think.
Joe, thank you so much. Thank you for your time. Thank you for writing a really important book. I think these kind of messages in the digital overstimulated world we're living in, especially our generation, the generation that are coming, are very, very important. And they're very simplifying, which I love, because it's very easy to write very complex things that are that try and make things more complicated than they are, in order to make yourself sound super smart, or to try and trick people to buy something, or to think you're a scientist. But I love stuff that is simplifying. It makes it much more accessible. And I think that is why I love this particular book so much. But I also really appreciate your honesty, because you're talking about topics and themes that, on one hand, very few people will ever get to experience with the crazy career that you had in YouTube, and that you're having in the media and all of these things, but also topics that are not always easy to talk about, which is the difficult, harder times. And that balance is exactly why we do what we do here. So thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. No, pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And I can't wait to see what happens next. So.
Safe.
I had a few words to say about one of my sponsors on this podcast. My girlfriend came upstairs yesterday when I was having a shower, and she said to me that she tried the Huel protein shake, which lives on my fridge over there. And she said, it's amazing. Low calories, you get your 20 odd grams of protein, you get your 26 vitamins and minerals, and it's nutritionally complete. In the protein space, there's lots of things, but it's hard to find something that is nice, especially when consumed just with water, and that is nutritionally complete. The salted caramel one, if you put some ice cubes in it and you put it in a blender and you try it, is as good as pretty much any milkshake on the market, just mixed with water. It's been a game changer for me, because I'm trying to drop my calorie intake and I'm trying to be a little bit more healthy with my diet. So this is where Huel fits in my life. Thank you, Huel, for making a product that I actually like.